Hey everyone, on this episode of 6 Degrees with Mike McKenna, I'm joined by Jamie Koharski, longtime referee in the AHL, ECHL, NCAA, OHL, you name it. We've shared the ice for over 20 years since we were teammates in Bantams. You won't meet a better guy than Jamie. It's always a pleasure talking with a friend, and some of my favorite on-ice moments occurred with Jamie wearing the stripes. Enjoy. Jamie, where do we even start, man? We go back, what, 23 years, I think, at this point?
It's got to be. I mean, it's 2000. I moved to St. Louis in 94, so that's 25 years ago. I think we played together in Bantam, so that would have been 95, 96, maybe.
I think so, yeah. How did that even happen, though? I mean, you're from Hamilton, Ontario, right? Originally, your family is? And you have some maritime background, too, but how did the Koharski family end up in St. Louis?
Well, as most people know with the last name, Dad was a longtime referee, and we lived in Hamilton and Burlington. And back then, the league came to Dad and asked if he'd be willing to relocate to the U.S. And back then, the league wasn't allowed to tell referees that they had to move. They had to have permission, had to be mutually agreed upon. And also back then, if you lived in Canada, you got paid in Canadian dollars. And if you lived in the U.S., you got paid in American. So that was almost, as soon as Dad said yes, he got about a 70% raise.
Yeah, he's probably pretty happy about that right off the bat, I'm sure.
Yeah. So yeah. They gave him the choice of Chicago, St. Louis, or I want to say Dallas. And he had just, over the years, traveled to St. Louis. He loved the people and made a lot of good friends in the St. Louis area. So that's where we moved.
What were you thinking when you showed up? I mean, that was a pretty big change.
Yeah, it was definitely a huge culture change. I remember when it really hit me how different it was we had a little bit of a light snowfall one night, and our bus stop, my brother and I, was right in the corner, right outside our house.
So that's a bloodbath on the roads in St. Louis. You know that.
Oh, and we're out there at 7:30 waiting for the bus, and our neighbors came out. We're like, what are you guys doing? We're waiting for the bus.
Yeah.
Any minute. Like, no, it snowed last night. School's canceled. We don't have school.
And you're just waiting for 18 inches for anything gets canceled. I mean, yeah, that happened. Did that happen much as a kid?
In growing up in Ontario, I don't remember. I mean, we didn't get too bad of snow, but it was definitely a lot colder than what it was in St. Louis, for sure.
What people don't know about you, though, is that you played hockey. You were a defenseman. We were teammates. We played on that Pee Wee or Bantam team together, I guess.
The Bantam team, yeah.
And that your dad ends up coaching it like a month into the season. I don't even know what happened to our coach. So, I mean, when you were young, did you have aspirations like everybody else of playing hockey and making it big time?
I did, just like any Canadian kid growing up. That was my dream, and it wasn't until I probably figured it out at a younger age than most. I was probably 13, 14 when I realized, I'm like, I am not good enough to play AAA in St. Louis, let alone make it to the NHL. And then obviously the skill level and the ability of the kids kept increasing and increasing every year. And I just kind of stayed, a little stagnant. So I turned to the dark side.
I tried to keep that hidden for a long time. I think that we'd been teammates then, and people always kind of giggled when they found out later on that, yeah, that was my defenseman when we were 13 years old, man. He kept me safe out there. And then
you kept my plus minus a little higher than it probably should have been, for sure.
You know, 23, 24 years later, whatever it is, we were still sharing the ice, which was incredible to me.
It was really, really cool. And you left. I have to thank you now in person. I think I sent you a text message. But when I retired from the American League, you posted a real nice message via social media. And it was very heartfelt. And that's kind of when you let the cat out of the bag and let everyone know. So, you know, I haven't told many people this, and not many people know, but you put it great. I mean, there's no one I shared the ice with longer than you, going back to when you played AAA hockey into juniors and then into pro. So it was kind of special. It was always fun to be on the ice with you.
And I don't think people really realize how much of a dynamic players have with referees out there. You know, there's guys in the locker room that really don't want to talk to the refs. They keep themselves disassociated from them. But there are plenty of guys, though, that build up a rapport with you guys, you know, and you spend so much time together on the ice. How can you not? It's like you're out there with a coworker, really.
And I think that's something that's unique to hockey more so than other sports. I don't know if it's just the culture and the way we all kind of come up through the same ranks. Hockey players weren't, unlike other sports, maybe where they're not kind of given everything at the age of 13, 14. If you're an elite player, you still have to grind it out and be on the bus. And I think there's a mutual respect going both ways between the officials and the players, because we kind of had the same trajectory through the system.
Yeah, you got to work your way up. I'm thinking about going back to that team we were together, though, on Bantams. We got into some wild things. I mean, we played a tournament in Houston. Do you remember that? I mean,
I do remember that.
I didn't even know they had youth hockey in Houston. I thought that we were an outpost in St. Louis. Next thing you know, we're getting on a flight to Houston. One guy's mom, Tony Miller, she's never flown. She's freaking out. We get down there. I don't even know what happened in the tournament, but the only thing I could remember is that they stuck you in the box after the period ended
Yes,
and gave you, I don't know what they gave you, like a 10-minute misconduct, and you had to stay in the box while the Zam was going around the ice.
I remember Dad was not on that trip. He was traveling for games. And I remember it was Mr. Miller. Greg was behind the bench. And I remember everything that led up to that. There was a player on the other team that was just running around, ended up kneeing me. And I might have been the fourth or fifth person that they had taken a run at. So I just kind of lost. And I remember it was a baseball with 8 seconds to go in the game. Baseball swing, match penalty, try to break the kid's ankle, I think it was. And the referee gave me a minor penalty for slashing, and I was insulted. I said, "You only give me two for that?" And I kind of lost my mind a little bit, and they gave me a 10. And okay, so I started skating off the ice, and they made me sit in the box after the game, and they put 10 minutes on the clock, and I'm sitting there like a stool watching the Zamboni go around when everyone's getting ready in the locker room.
Well, I remember we got off the ice and we all look around. I mean, where's Coho? And somebody peeked their head back out of the room. He's still in the box. And then, everybody starts filtering out of the locker room to take a look. And there you are sitting there, on the stool in the box with your stick vertical, like you're ready to go out for another shift.
An equal mixture of embarrassment and anger. I was so upset because I was refereeing too at the time, so I
Right,
knew the
yeah.
rules. I knew that was not what you're supposed to do, but
How old were
I
you when
guess
you
a few things
started? How
different.
old were you when you started officiating?
I was 9.
Yeah.
I had started in Ontario
It was
with
in the
the
blood, wasn't it?
yeah, many, many mites. I remember going, my brother played hockey for a year when we lived in Canada, and I just remember going to see his games and getting excited when I saw the referees come on the ice.
Yeah, well, how can
So
you? I
I
mean, it's
was.
what your dad did. Your uncle still does. Terry Koharski's still a referee in the American Hockey League, living the dream there.
Yeah, I mean, both those guys have had incredible careers in their respective leagues. I mean, Dad was 32 years on ice in the NHL, and he's going on, I think, 42 or 43 years consecutive being employed by the National Hockey League, and Terry's a legend
He
in the American
absolutely
League, as
is.
you well know.
Oh, what's so funny about Terry is the guys, when they first come in the league, they're terrified of him. And I do think he's mellowed a little bit over the years because part of it is that the league has gotten younger with the officials too, right? Guys don't know half the guys that are doing the games. And it used to be that most of the people you were on the ice with, you knew what to expect out of them. So
Right.
Terry's one of the last guys left that you know what you're getting. And the old guys all love him now. And it used to be
Yeah,
really
and
adversarial. And anytime they see Coho on the sheet, you're like, it's going to be a good one tonight, boys. Let's go. Just don't say a word to him. Young guys, stay away. Don't talk to him. And we're going to have a good night.
that's key. That
Yeah.
was key, because Terry had been around such a long time that he would take more. And he'd be willing to talk more with an older veteran guy. But if it was a young kid, his feet haven't even been wet yet, and in pro hockey started melting off, Terry would lose his mind.
Oh, I'd tee him
And
up
it
in a
was accepted.
heartbeat.
Yeah, I remember a great example. The first game I worked with Terry, we went into the four-man system, was in Providence on a Sunday afternoon. So it was
Classic Providence. They take every Sunday afternoon they can.
oh
Three
my God.
national anthems, nothing but school
Yeah.
kids in there. Yeah, if it's the end of a 3-3, you know you're going to be playing in Providence because that's all they play. They play like 13 or 14 a year. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think if you bought a ticket, you get to drop a ceremonial puck drop or something. It just took forever to get the
Yeah,
game
that's
started
right.
there.
So what did Terry do?
So I'm down low, plays buzzing along, and out of the corner of my eye, up in the high slot, I see someone just get absolutely drilled. Absolutely drilled. I'm like, okay, good. I didn't get a good look at it. I don't need to guess. Terry's back there. That's his area of responsibility. And the guy's laying on the ice. So play keeps going for a second. Team touches the puck. I'm like, okay, here comes the whistle. Let's go, Terry. No whistle. So I look back. Terry's 150 feet away, leaning over the visiting bench, giving it to some poor rookie. Just absolutely giving. And play is going on. And we end up, goalie covers the puck. We have a whistle. And everyone comes to me and says, what happened? I go, I have no idea. I said, but if you guys want to go ask Terry, good luck. And he's still yelling and screaming. And players just skated away. That was just kind of the respect that he was able to generate over his career, because there's not many guys that can get away with some of his antics.
Oh man, my absolute favorite one was when he told Brad Marchand to take a hike. This was in Providence. It was the exact same thing. It was in Providence, and it was Marchand's rookie year, and he had started the year in Providence, and he went up for like two games, right? And he comes back to Providence. It's the second period, and I clearly remember because I had to skate from the far crease to the bench, right? And Coho's on my right. Marchand's in the slot. Marchand starts lipping off to Coho. And again, it's his rookie year. Terry loses it. And he just immediately goes into his... What? You think you get two games in the fucking show? You think you're fucking hot shit? Fuck you! Right to the box, 10 minutes. And the best part... Marchand never played another game in the American Hockey League after that. He got called up the next day and never played in the American League again. And Coho just completely big-dogged him.
They're from the same hometown, too. They're both Nova Scotia boys. And Terry played with Brad's dad and Junior or something growing up. Or played against him. So I think the way Terry tells the story every chance he gets is he tells him that he goes, I used to kick the shit out of your father back in the day. You're not even close to being as tough as he is.
That was literally the funniest moment on the ice for me in my whole career. And it's midway through the second period. I'm skating off to the bench for a TV timeout.
But you know, all that being said, I don't want to paint the picture of Terry just going out there and do whatever he wants. Terry was probably the best referee not to work in the NHL. I mean, and he couldn't, if he wasn't a good referee, he couldn't get away with saying some of the stuff to players and coaches and still have that respect.
Oh yeah. And I don't want people to think he's just a wild card doing whatever. Like Coho is legitimately, Terry is one of the most respected people I've ever come across in the game, really is. And I do think that that's something that's missing in refereeing though, that when guys get on the ice and he's out there, they respect him. And you're in the locker room telling your players, if you respect this person, he'll treat you like gold out there. Half the guys we get in the league now, you don't even know who they are. How are you going to react to them? You don't know what to do,
no,
right?
And the culture and everything has kind of changed a little bit. Going to the four-man system, however many years ago it was, kind of took the personality of the officials out of the game. You can't go out and referee a game the way you would want to, because you still have a partner with you that's going to be doing what he does, and you can't control that. So I miss the days of being out there by yourself and knowing when to let the boys go a little bit and recognizing when to rein them back in. That was kind of the art and the fun of refereeing.
It reminds me of Jeff Smith, who used to do American League games, and Smitty was well known for swallowing the whistle, and he'd be skating down the ice, quite literally waving off penalties. Just play, just keep going. And that was always a joke, is that Smitty had a flight 5 minutes after the game and he's got to get out of there. But that's what you knew that when you drew him for the game, that's what you were going to get. You know, and it was the same thing. Yeah, it was accepted. I mean, this was just the personality, or, you know, if somebody else was working the game, oh, he calls everything. But you knew it going into it. Like, do you think the two-man system has, you know, obviously it's taken the personality out, but has it made it more difficult for guys to call the game?
No, honestly, I think it's easier to call the game now. I think having two referees on the ice has made the game better. I think the players can just go out there and play and not worry about, I don't know, shit going on behind the whistle that's going to get missed. And But on the flip side of it, it's made it harder to develop relationships with players and coaches. But overall, I think it's good for the game. And the game's so fast. I don't care how great a shape or how good a skater you are as a referee. There's no way you're going to be able to see everything by yourself. I mean, we watched in the playoffs this year in the National Hockey League how tough it is to catch everything when there's two of you on the ice. So I don't think we'd ever go back to the days of having only one.
Don't you think it's made it harder too, in terms of at least public opinion, because replay shows everything 1,000 times at a minuscule level, slowed down to the nth degree, that you guys are seeing it in real time, and you can't from even from the replay tell what you guys see, whether it's out of the corner of your eye or in front of you. That's impossible to make as a judgment just looking for replay, but fans sure think they know no matter what, right? Out of
Oh,
this guy,
100%.
miss it. I mean, there's got to be moments during games, though, where you just think back and go, I don't know what I saw. I can't make that call. You know,
Yeah,
does that happen often in games?
quite a bit, and it took me a long time in my career to recognize the fact that you get yourself into more trouble when you guess at a play. You guess, you call what you think you saw, and a lot of the times our gut was 90% of the time we're probably right. If we guess and we make a call, we're probably right, just with our hockey sense and our gut instinct. But that 10% of the time that you're wrong does more of an insert does more of a disservice to the game than it would be if you just kind of let it go. If you don't call it, you get in more trouble by calling bad penalties than you do by letting them sort it out themselves sometimes.
So what's the best way to handle it when you blow a call? Because I'm sure it's happened to everybody. How do you deal with it? Do you go to the coaches? Do you just go to your partners on the ice, your linesman, your referee? What's the best course of action for it?
You have to own up to it. You have to own up. You try and bullshit you guys or coaches and try and talk your way out of why you talk your way out of why you didn't call something or why you called a bad penalty. I mean, video doesn't lie, like you said. So you lose a little bit of credibility, I think, if you try and justify a bad call or a missed call. So and I think you gain a little bit of respect if you go to a coach who's losing his mind or a player and say, listen, I have a feeling you might be right. I said, I go, I have a feeling you might be right. Let's leave it at that. And more often than not, the response is, you owe us. Well, you owe us. I said, well, I don't owe you a power play. I owe you a better effort. That's what I owe you. I don't owe you. There's no makeup calls. There's no, I'm not going to let you guys get away with something now because I let them get away with something, but I owe you a better effort. And I think that gets a lot of respect. You can't do it. If you're doing it 4, 5, 6 times a game, then you probably don't belong to be, you probably don't deserve to be at that level anymore as an official, but you have to own up and man up to it.
Well, and it could just start going back and forth and end up in this vicious cycle if you're just trying to call penalties to even things out. I'm sure it can get out of hand in a big hurry like that.
Yeah, and then you're lost. You're playing catch up the rest of the night, and it's not a good, and we've all had it. And we've all had that sinking feeling in their gut when you get in the locker room afterwards with your head hanging low, saying you kind of kicked the dog in that game. That's not a good feeling that you want.
You guys must have the same highs and lows after games, though, that players do. And I don't think fans even realize that. I think that there's a large contingent of them that just think you guys are out there joyriding around the ice. Ho ho, we're having fun. We're refereeing this thing. You
Oh
guys
yeah,
live
we're there to.
live and die by this too, right? It's just like a big game for us. I'm sure that if you guys call a great game, you're sitting in the room cracking Bud Lights, happy as can be, right? And if it goes
Yeah.
poorly, you probably walk out of the building pretty upset yourself.
You absolutely do. And it's I mean, fans think we're out there just to prevent their team from winning.
Oh,
That's what they
you're still
think.
biased. Every referee is biased. It is impossibly impartial. Yeah, they see what they
So
want to see, right?
it's but no, it's there's nothing better than walking off the ice and being able to look yourself in the mirror saying that you did a really good job. And it's for players, for you, it might be making a big save or a shutout or whatever it is, or a big win. For us, it's making that big call at the right time, that must get call, that we're being at the net and seeing that the puck went in by an inch, or stepping up and calling a penalty shot late in the tie game that has to be called, where a lot of guys might kind of be scared of that situation when we call it a trip or a hook. But it's no, it can be very rewarding, but it's also a very lonely job because you're celebrating with two or three guys in the locker room after, and then you go your separate ways and you're by yourself in the hotel.
Yeah.
Or you're in the car by yourself.
I think that's what some people that know me know this too about my grandfather, that he would officiate until he was 76 years old right before he died. But I know what he loved about it was just coming in the locker room and seeing his friends, working it with the guys. So maybe dive into a little bit what that camaraderie is like. What's it like in the officials room for you guys before, after, during games?
Well, we're all pretty much cut from the same cloth. You kind of got to have a certain personality and demeanor about you if you want to even be a part of
officiating. Your dad once said that you're all just frustrated hockey players.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. We're all just kind of we're all pretty happy to still be a part of the game, a small part of it as it is that we are, but we're still a part of it and fortunate to be out there in that environment.
I'm trying to think back in your arc to making it to where you are, you know, still doing college games, American League recently, but I don't think people really understand the route that you have to take to get to that level. And I know some of that's changed. You know, they're plucking guys right out of pro hockey to do refereeing linesman jobs now, and that seems to be the trend of what they're going. But especially for your era, you really had to grind it out. I mean, you took a similar path that I did. And you worked junior, you worked college. You know, explain to people everything you had to do to even get to the American League.
Yeah. Well, I started, like I said earlier, started refereeing little tiny kids in Canada when I was 9, but my officiating career never really took off till I moved to St. Louis. As a matter of fact, the first game I worked in St. Louis was with Grandpa Bill.
It was the first
one?
The first one
I worked at the, yep, oh, at the man. Outdoor arena.
Amazing.
What was the outdoor rink? There was no lines painted on the ice.
It could have been Clayton and could have been Steinberg. Could have been.
There was Clayton.
Clayton, that's right.
It
yeah.
was Clayton, sure. So that was my introduction to St. Louis hockey.
And we were pretty far along at that point, too. You talk about 94. I mean, we probably had 20 sheets in town. You picked the one rink and you got the assignment of the one rink that wasn't up to modern standards of all places.
But no, it was. So I started working in at 14. You don't really work your age group. So I was doing 8 to 12, 8 to 13 year old games, and working with all the local guys there. And then kind of as I got older, kind of getting moved up and getting some AAA games and going
and
all
within,
over.
This is within USA Hockey at that point, right?
This is all with USA Hockey and through MIHOA, Missouri Ice Hockey Officials Association, who do a tremendous job. Yeah. Developing young officials. And then from there, from working AAA games, I got invited to go to the North American Hockey League training camp for officials when I was 17. Went there, I must have had a good outing at training camp, and started working as a linesman in the North American.
And that league, by the way, at that time was mostly 19, 20, 21-year-olds. So you're 17 years old, and you were pretty young, I think, right, compared to most people working those games?
Oh, by at least 3, 4, 5 years. I mean, I was the youngest person on staff for sure, and I'd worked mostly in St. Louis, Springfield, Danville, that kind of the three cities I could drive to without having to miss too much school.
And that league was an absolute circus back then. I played in it. I know what it was like. I can't imagine being a linesman with those mutants on the ice.
Cam Jansen played there. I'm just thinking of St. Louis guys. Danny McNabb, George Cantrell. I remember the guy, John Pyrick, that played for the Sting.
Oh, Pyro. Rest in peace. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. But no, that was, you kind of saw a lot of different situations there at a young age as a linesman. I mean, going into Springfield on a Friday night, Springfield, Illinois, and it'd be filled to the rafters with the beer cups lined all around the boards and the glass, and just the no offense to anyone, but the creatures that would be there cheering on the team. It was eye opening.
Man, that I look back on it, and that was trial by fire coming into that environment. And I was actually fortunate to play in Springfield because, like you said, we had fans, and they actually expected something out of us. There were some teams in the league. I mean, I remember Cleveland, there might be 20 people there, you know, and I don't know whether the team was just a tax write-off or what it was for the owner. But in Springfield,
I think the 20 people there the 20 people there, I think, were just kind of killing time before their practice over on the other sheet at the arena.
Yeah, you know, their kid had a AAA game afterwards or something. Yeah. But, you know, Springfield, they expected stuff out of us. And it was a fun environment, but it was also a little bit of pressure. And I just think back, though. I mean, the first game, I think we were on the ice together. You got bled all over. And your jersey was – your sweater was just beat red. And I remember you coming out for the second or third, and it was clean. I was like, what did you do? Yeah, ice water. Got it out.
So yeah, that's all it is.
Yeah.
That's all it is. It was – I remember I broken my nose three times in my career. Once was in the East Coast League down in Beaumont.
Not
Texas.
Playing. You got your nose broken officiating here. Let's...
Officiating.
Right.
Yes. Before we even wore the half visors.
Yeah.
I was skating up the ice, following play on the bench side and in front of the Texas bench. And John Snowden, who's now
head coach of the Growler.
Yeah. Out in the rock.
Just won the Kelly Cup in the ECHL. Yeah.
So he was coming on the ice for a line change, and I'm not paying any attention. I learned a lesson here real quick where you don't skate that close to the boards, because I ran right into his knee coming. That's how close I was to the bench. And I ran right into his knee, and my face just exploded about maybe 6 minutes into the second period. So went out, doctor went and cleaned me up, stuck the tampons up my nose.
Say the old nose tampons. Yeah. Classic hockey play.
And go back out and finish. Went back out. I might have missed 5 minutes of action. Went out and finished the game, and then had to get in the car and drive 6.5 hours back to my apartment myself.
Yeah, because that was an outpost too. What's the protocol when you guys get injured on the ice? Because you don't have team trainers. You know, you're largely in the building by yourselves. Does the guy from the home team, the away team, who takes care of you? And then even if it's simple things like, you know, on ice, are you covered with insurance? If you get hurt on the ice, does the league take care of you? How does that work?
Yeah, the leagues, if you get hurt on the ice, the leagues do a good job with that. Because we're all, unless you're under contract as a referee to the NHL, we're all independent contractors. So it kind of fall under the workman's comp laws in whatever state that you were working in. But I never had any issues with any leagues not stepping up and taking care of me when need be. And the home teams are always great. Whether you need something in game that happens, you need to get checked out or get work done before, the team docs and trainers are always, for the most part, very, very professional with us. And even the equipment guys, if we need skate sharpenings or laces or something sewn on our pants, the equipment guys, as long as you don't go to them 40 minutes before the game starts, if you get there early, they'll take care of you.
When you were grinding in the coast, where were you based out of? And do you have any travel stories that stick out that were just a nightmare when you were doing it?
I did full time. I did 3 seasons in the East Coast League. So my first year was 03. When was the lockout? Was it 04, 05?
04, 05, because I came out the year after. My first year was 05, 06. And I think by then you were in the American League as well. So that would make sense time-wise.
So I never had Jets. The only league I've worked that I hadn't worked here, that I haven't worked on the ice with you. Yeah. So it would have been 03, 04. I was living in Biloxi, Mississippi. They had I went to go work pro hockey, and I'm living in Mississippi.
That's a good trade-off.
It was fun. It was fun. I mean, most of my games were in Biloxi, Pensacola, Lafayette, Louisiana. So I was in the sun. All sun in the water all season long. So that was kind of a fun year. And then from there, after the next year, I moved to Atlanta with a couple guys in the league apartment. The league pays for the apartment. It cuts back on travel expenses and hotels. So I lived in Gwinnett for a year and then moved to lovely Reading, Pennsylvania the following year, where I did half American League and half Coast League. Travel nightmare stories. I was on the road. It was over New Year's. I had to leave Christmas night to get on the road down to Charlotte, and I did the whole Carolinas, Georgia, Mississippi swing. And it was a 2-week trip. And I remember my last game of the trip was in Charlotte.
And you're driving the whole thing, right? You're in your car the whole time.
I'm in my 2001 Pontiac Grand Prix with 300,000 miles on it, driving all over the country by myself. But I remember we're in Charlotte, and I always liked staying in Charlotte because back then in the Coastal League, we had to stay at the Red Roof Inn. We had to stay at Red Roof Inn. But the one in Charlotte actually had hallways and an elevator, so you thought you were at a real hotel.
That's rare for a roof, man. Yeah, it's usually outdoors. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Just drive to your room in Charlotte. So after the game, I was so wiped. It had been it was 10 games and 14 nights or whatever it was. And I'm at the bar with the guys having a couple drinks, and my phone rings, and it was our boss. I answered it. And he goes, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm having my second beer at the bar." He goes, "Well, you got to go work. It's Saturday night." He goes, "You got to work in Pensacola tomorrow." I said, "Okay, what time is my flight in the morning?" And he goes, no, you're driving." And that was, I might be a little off, but it's got to be at least a 7-8 hour drive. And it's midnight now. The game's at 2 o'clock Central Time the next day. So I had to go at midnight. I had to leave the bar. Thank gosh, I only had a beer and a half.
I say, yeah. I mean, you weren't seven deep at that point, which is good. Yeah.
So I had to go to the hotel, pack up all my stuff. I never even emptied my bag from the game that night. So my stuff was just soaked. I had to drove to the apartment in Atlanta, slept for 2.5 hours, got up, worked the game, and then had to drive all the way back to Reading, Pennsylvania the next 2 days. So it was, that was probably the worst travel I had, which is not bad.
Were you hanging the sweater out the window trying to get it dry? You know, roll the window up so that it's hanging out halfway.
All I did is I went right in the apartment. I didn't even wash it. I just threw everything in the dryer.
Would you have to get creative on the road though when it came to that, drying your gear out? Because you're handling it most of the time. It's not like you'd load in at midnight and let it dry in the locker room most of the time, I'd imagine. You've just got it in your car in your hotel room, right?
Yeah, it gets gross, especially when you're rooming with other officials on the road, and you get two sets of equipment being aired out, and the skates are being hung over the dryer or the heater in the room, and it's a pretty rank situation most of the time.
Who were some of the referees and linesmen that you really enjoyed working with over the years?
All of them. I always loved working with Terry. The few times we got to work together, just because of the, not only because he was my uncle, but just seeing the respect that he had on the ice from the players and officials, and that was always something I strive to kind of mimic and get to in my career. But I mean, I made my best friends David Banfield, Jason Finley, all the guys, because we. It's hyperbole, but we go to war with those guys on a nightly basis, and they're our only friends in the building amidst thousands of screaming people that hate us. So it's you develop such a close bond with these guys, and even though we don't see each other quite as often as we would like, when you run into each other over the years, you just pick up right back to normal. So it's the shared experience that not many other people get to go through that we've gone through together is very special.
Yeah. Band of brothers in some ways, right? How do you deal with the crazy fans, man? Cause like you said, you're public enemy number one in every building. There's some that you'd skate on the ice. They immediately start booing you. Like they'll announce it's Jamie Koharski. Boo.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
You know, I mean, how do you handle that? Honestly,
you know, it's coming. You know, it's coming.
Do you wear the black hat and kind of feed off it though?
It'll get you going. Like, yeah. I remember there was a guy in Hershey.
Don't you want to just skate out and wave? You know, like the guy in Slapshot who gives the guy the finger, you know, as he's skating on the ice.
That's every referee's dream, is the last game to skate off the ice like that.
With two middle like fingers that. In the air.
Yeah. Double bird.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's a little tongue in cheek, but it's
sure.
Growing up at a young age, Dad always instilled in me that when players or coaches or parents at that time are yelling at you, they're not yelling at you. They're yelling at the black and white jersey that you have on. They don't, and it sounds corny, but Dad always says it at our camps. He goes, if they knew who you were, they'd like you. You're a good guy. You're a passionate guy. You love the sport. You're a nice young kid, but you put that black and white jersey on and people just start yelling at that. And when I got into junior and pro hockey, it all just becomes white noise. I mean, those fans paid good money to get their ticket and go, and it's professional hockey, so they can yell and say whatever they want. We don't hear them. I mean, you hear them, but you don't. It's expected. There's a guy in Hershey that after you line up for the national anthem, it's dead quiet in the building, and right before the singer starts to sing, this fan up in the nosebleeds, yell, "Koharski, you suck! Have another dunk." And I don't know if he did it to every referee, but he definitely did it to me, Terry, and David Banfield. And it was just, it got to the point where I didn't hear him one night. He didn't yell, and I had someone go check to make sure he was okay.
Right. You're worried, like, if the guy's all right. You expect it at that point.
Yeah. So it was, but it's all good. It's all fun. I never had any super crazy experiences with fans even throwing shit or taking it above just the verbal abuse, which is fine.
If so you never had the Mr. Larson moment from Happy Gilmore where you count on me waiting for you in the parking lot. That never happened to you?
And there's been those threats, but right. No one's ever followed through on it.
A bunch of cowards, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I'd be walking out the parking lot like Carrie Fraser story with my skates over my hands, telling them to bring it on.
I mean, you've worked in a lot of buildings, and you've worked in some beautiful ones and some absolute dumps. I'm trying to think, going back with ECHL, NAHL, American League, college, what are some of the better buildings you've worked in and some of the worst buildings that you've worked in? Because it's been a wide swath.
I'm an old school guy. I always like the small barns.
Shitty ones too. Yeah, me too. I like playing in Bingo and Syracuse and those old places.
Bingo, Syracuse are probably my two favorite buildings in the American League. I mean, the fans there were just right on top of you. They hated me. Hated me, which is kind of a badge of honor sometimes. It just shows if a fan base in a minor league city hates you as a referee, it's because you've been around long enough. That something happened in that building and they don't forget.
Right.
But I mean, in the Coast League, I love Toledo, the old Toledo Sports Arena there at the
walk. We had to walk through the crowd to get to the ice.
Yeah.
The glass was like 2 feet high. They're taking swipes at you over the glass in warmups.
I had a game there where the home team was fighting a home fan, a season ticket holder
behind over the glass. Yeah. They didn't even have glass behind the bench. They were just sitting in the crowd there.
Yeah, and I'm looking, and I was young. I was like, "What do I give anyone a penalty?" Like it's like
that's a two-team literally start. Like slap shot when the refs look at each other and they go, "Should we get involved?" I'm trying to think of what part of the movie that is, but that's when they're up in the stands fighting everybody. Should we get involved? That's when the Hansons went into the crowd.
Yes, yeah.
Because Coach Reggie that's Dunlop true. Said that somebody threw a monkey wrench and they were defending the dignity of Charleston, and the visiting team just watched it happen.
Yeah, we're not getting involved. No need to get ourselves involved in that. Let them sort it out themselves.
Yeah,
but no, I mean, Toledo, the old Windsor Arena in the OHL was awesome. I just liked where the fans just being so into it, and there might only be 2,500 people in the building, but it sounds like 20,000 because of just how low the roof is and how close they are to you. So those were always fun. For some reason, I never liked working in Albany. At the rink and at the arena in Albany, I don't know what it was, and you played there, you spent a lot of time there. Something was depressing.
It was really dark in that building. Yeah.
Maybe that was the difference, but it's funny how I didn't like that one, but I loved going to the War Memorial in Syracuse.
Yeah, well, Albany was, I don't know, Albany was okay when Charlotte was there as the affiliate when I was playing in the American League. They at least got some fans, and then I came in the first year, it went back to Jersey, and our fans just plummeted. You know, it'd be friends and family in the building. And, you know, that's not to say people weren't passionate and there weren't real hockey fans there. There just weren't many. And I don't know why it didn't work, but you always knew something was going to go wrong in that building too. I remember the first game we had coming back, Devils are back. And sure enough, somebody smashes the glass out right by the benches. And I go, "Oh, boys, watch this. This is going to be a while." And the rookies are going, "What are you talking about?" I go, "Oh, you just watch. I've seen this before, guys." So the rink crew comes out, you know, and the rink crew's just like completely out to lunch. They bring a piece of glass out on the ice that they're going to replace. It's too wide. They bring the wrong piece out. So we're already 10 minutes delayed. They go back behind. And I go, oh, yeah, guys, I know what's coming. Keep your ears open. What are you talking about? Oh, just keep your ears open. 2 minutes later, whee, they're firing up the bandsaw. They got the table saw going back there. They're cutting a piece of plexiglass. They wheel it out. It still has like the brown paper wrapper on the backside of it. They put it in next to the penalty bench where it had broken. 25-minute delay. They had to cut a piece of glass. And
meanwhile, the coaches are yelling at the referees because it's our fault.
Yeah, get it's your guys together. The glass ready. Yeah. Have you had that a bunch? I mean, what's it like when a coach comes up to you and blames you for something that's completely out of your control?
It's – you just kind of look at him, and I would repeat what he's complaining about to me. I would repeat it back to him so maybe he hears it in a different way until he realizes how fucking ridiculous he sounds. But it's – when you get in the emotion and everything, you just got to – if you're frustrated and vent, you got to – let it loose on somebody, and coaches probably think, well, players are tired of hearing me yell at them, so I'm going to yell at the referees now because I got to get this out. So it's just nature of the beast.
I mean, I know we've talked about not doing even up calls, make up calls, those things, but tell me in the back of your head, when a team's been motherfucking you for the whole game, you know, just absolutely riding you, is it not in the back of your head that in some way, in some form, I really don't want these guys to win the game? And it may not affect what's coming through on the ice, but I'm sure in some way, though, that feeling is there. It's got to play into it somehow, sometime.
There's pretty much three ways it's going to go. Is it A, you're just going to ignore it, block it out of your mind, and just react when something happens. The other way is it's going to work. The coach has got to you, and you're going to call a weak one just to maybe hopefully shut him up. Or shut the players up. But the third way is what I always preferred to do was I wasn't going to not call something or call something based on the coach yelling, but I wasn't going to call a weak one. I was going to work really, really hard not to call a soft penalty to put that team on the power play just to appease them. Because if you do that, then you lose credibility with the other team. And they think, well, you only called that because he's yelling at you. So maybe we're going to start yelling and screaming at you.
Right.
I remember later in my career when I can get away with something like this. There's a coach in the American League. I don't want to. I'll say his name. Mike Havlin. Great guy off the ice. Yeah.
I played for him in Norfolk. For him in Norfolk briefly. Yep.
He was always a good guy off the ice. We always got along off the ice. But on the ice, he was just. We'll say emotional would be a good way to put it. And he would just all game long yell and scream. And I tried everything. I'd given him bench minors. I'd gone over and talked to him. I've thrown him out of games. Nothing worked.
You don't see that happen very often anymore. It's pretty rare a guy gets tossed.
No, exactly. But I just, your wit's in. You got to try and figure out something to get this guy to quit yelling. So in Binghamton, he was coaching Hershey. At the time, and Hershey player gets hooked in front of the bench just a little bit, wasn't a penalty, but he goes down pretty easy, took a dive, and Javi right away is on the bench, arms up, yelling and screaming, and there's a nothing play. So then something else happens, he starts yelling and screaming. I'm like, you know what, maybe I'm going to try this to shut him up. So the next four or five shifts, Binghamton kind of clued in. They're like, Coe's not calling. Hershey's not getting a power play if he's yelling and screaming. Guys are getting crushed. Like, there's probably six or seven penalties that I let go that are definite, at least 2 minute penalties. And every time something would happen, he'd yell. I'd look up at him, kind of shrug my shoulders. And the next whistle, he goes, are you going to fucking call anything? I said, no, I'm not. I said, you keep yelling like that. I said, I'm going to let them do what they want till you have a heart attack. And maybe finally we'll get some peace and quiet around here. And he was furious. You could see the players burying their face on the bench, chuckling. They were laughing because they knew I was at my wit's end, and they were probably at their wit's end listening to him.
Yeah.
But that was, I could kind of get away with it at that point in my career. It's not something I'd recommend most people doing.
There's some characters in your game, in your side of things, though, and I look at what Wes McCauley's done in the NHL, and people adore him now because look what he does on the penalty calls, the no-goal calls, the offside calls. He hams it up a little bit. He plays it up. He's the only guy I can think of that's willing to do it, though. And then I also think about how after games, the referees never have to face the media. And I'm curious your thoughts on that, because to me, I'd kind of like to see them do it so they can give it back to people and at least explain things rather than having to go through an intermediary. Do you think that would be a good or bad thing, though? Because just from the outside looking in, I think that would be good. And I'd like to hear your thoughts, though, from your perspective of having been in the trenches and knowing what that feeling's like.
I think in theory, it's a great idea. I think in theory, it would work well for the game, but that's assuming that like a guy like Wes McCauley would have no problem facing the scrutiny of the media or taking questions in a press conference, where there's some other guys who might not be as comfortable and would get a little tongue-tied talking, and it might be end up doing a disservice to the game. They won't be able to get their point across as clearly as others. So I think overall it'd be good. Maybe if it's, like you said, an intermediary that goes in and gets a statement, or a PR person goes in and gets a statement from the official and then come back out and relay that to the media. I think that might work. That would work better. And I think it would just show the transparency and the accountability that maybe these guys have. Cause I think they do. I'm not a big basketball fan, but I think they do it in the NBA, where they come out and the crew chief will face a pool reporter. I know they do it in Major League Baseball. So I think overall it would serve the game well, and it would show the human side of the officials a little bit more to the fans.
Man, when Wes McCauley did that initial 5 minutes for fighting, tell me that you guys in the referee's room didn't all look at each other and go, he did it. Somebody finally did it.
He said he was going to do it and he did it.
Yeah. Was it like that?
It's our jaws all dropped. Like, we can't believe he actually did it. That's awesome. That's awesome. And you know what? It's not Wes being wanting to make it about him, or it's not Wes being the show. That's just Wes. That's his personality.
It was authentic. Yeah.
Game. He got it. Honestly, his father was the same way. His dad was my dad's mentor when dad first broke into the league. But no, that's just Wes. And I don't think there's other guys that could get away with it without it seeming forced. But that's just, Wes didn't have, like, when he goes and does the no-goal calls with the suspense, that's not him planning that out at the beginning of the game. That's just him being so caught up in the moment and being connected. And it was just, I think it's awesome.
Well, it resonated with people. I think that's the best part of it. And it humanizes what you guys do. And that's kind of what I mean with the media, that if a guy would at least have a chance to explain that, you know, it may look like it on the video, but I didn't see that. And I'm sorry I didn't see it, but it happens and it's a fast game. You know, just even a statement from the person, I just feel would help, because I can't stand seeing fans nonstop blame referees for losses. It's the biggest chicken shit cop-out move from people. It's a sore loser type of thing to do, because I can think of maybe, I don't know, five. I could probably count on my one hand how many times I've seen a ref truly blow a game for a team. You know, right. It just doesn't happen. But that's the perception, is that, oh, the referees gave it to him. Somebody's biased. I mean, how do you...
Let me clear the air there with the bias statement.
Please do so, yeah.
We hate you guys equally.
it's a two-way street.
we don't care. Literally, we do not care about the outcome of the game. To a man, to a referee, in any sport, I'd venture to say that we literally do not care. Because we, despite what fans may think, we are held accountable. But it's just, there's too much going on in a game, in a hockey game, that we have to worry about, that we're not worried about the outcome. Like, we truly, truly aren't. Sorry, that's kind of a tangent I went on. And I commend you for sticking up for the officials. I've seen it over the years so many times, via social media and statements you've made with the media.
Well, that's pretty easy when your grandpa did it his whole life. You know, and I know that he was somebody who was loved by players when he was on the ice because he yep. loved to teach. He'd love to call penalties that weren't penalties. I mean, he'd call he'd call splashing if he wanted to call splashing. You know, but he made the game fun. And I know that there's guys that wear the stripes that make the game fun and people enjoy it a lot more that are playing. And I'm wondering for you guys if you're involved in a game that's really close, it's going back and forth, you're skating end to end, there's hardly any penalties. Is there times where you guys just look out and smile and go, this is an amazing game, I'm glad to be part of it?
Oh, more often than not. More often than not. I mean, I still get that feeling, I don't know, 20-some-odd years into a pro hockey career where it's just, this is awesome. Like, I'm out here. Like, there's, even in college, being lucky enough to do a couple of Frozen Fours, just skating out in the ice and standing at center ice for the national anthem and it's jam full of fans and you just kind of look around and you get goosebumps. Just pinch me. I never thought I'd have this moment. I fell short of my ultimate goal of working in the National Hockey League, but I don't think by any means that diminished the feeling of working the levels that I've been fortunate enough to work. And it's just skate around and you get in that mode of like, this is a great game. I love being out here. Now you start thinking, okay, don't do anything to screw it up. Don't get in the way. Don't.
Right.
Yeah. Don't wake the players up. They don't even know you're out here right now. Let them do their thing and get involved when the game needs you to. So it's a great sport to be a part of on any side.
One of my favorite parts of your career, and people can YouTube and find it, was when you worked the AHL All-Star game and they had you mic'd up for it.
Oh, that's not where I thought you were going. I thought there was another YouTube clip that you were going to go to.
We can go to that later if you want to, but this is a good one. I mean, you got to really, same thing. You show your personality. I think, it humanized what you guys were doing. It's an honor to do games like that, though, right? I mean, when you get selected to do an All-Star game or to go deep into the playoffs, you know, explain how that works, though, because a lot of people don't understand. It's really a merit-based thing, right?
For playoffs, especially. We get evaluated and supervised throughout the season, whether it's a supervisor in person or someone watching the game on video or on AHL Live or whatever it is, or the war room in the NHL, and you get graded and you get rewarded in playoffs. I mean, the season ends and we're on pins and needles hoping that we get that email saying that we made the playoff roster, and then you get your assignments, games 1 through 3 from the first round, and then you work your third game and then you're sitting on pins and needles waiting for that next assignment, hoping that next assignment comes. And I was fortunate that three times I was able to reach the third round, the conference finals in the American League, which was awesome for me to be, I think the only guys at the time that were getting that deep in the playoffs as referees were guys that were under contract with the NHL and Terry. Mm-hmm. So to be one of those few guys that were just selected to get that deep, that was a very proud moment that I cherish. But with the All-Star game selection, that's a selection kind of thanking the officials for their time put in. And it was just a great moment to be able to have my parents and my super pregnant wife and
yeah.
to be able to come in, because we're on the road so much by ourselves on the year. We're traveling, we're missing. We don't have home games, so we're missing birthdays and anniversaries, and I missed proms and homecomings in high school because I wanted to go line a North American League game. Yeah. So there's a lot of sacrifice that you have to go through and that you put your family through. So to have a weekend like the All-Star game where the league treats you first class, you're invited to all the shindigs and the parties and the galas, and to have your family to share it with you for a brief moment of time was the best part.
Oh, side benefit too. What's your Marriott balance look like these days?
Oh, it's empty now.
No, depleted. Yeah,
empty now. But back in the day, it was that was the perks. We didn't make much money. I think the most I made in the American League 1 year is $32,000.
Yeah. Getting paid. That's going to shock people. That's going to really shock people.
Yeah, I mean, it's you talk about the sacrifices with the family, you're also sacrificing bank accounts. If you're chasing the dream, you're paying your dues and during the season, you don't have time really for another job if you're working 3-4 games a week plus travel. And
it takes a special situation to be able to work a second job, you know. Like I mean, I know Terry is a good example. He has another job, and that's part of the reason why you can continue to referee like this. But it's there's not many like that can find something that works that allows you to do this on the weekends.
That allows you to travel and be able to take right. time off and make up for it in the summertime. I mean, that's where we talked about having to be passionate to do this job. I mean, it's more than just the traveling. You're not making any money. Until you get signed to the NHL, you're not making anything. Now, when you get signed to the NHL, you're doing very well and making a very, very comfortable living. And those guys are fortunate to be able to make what they make, but they've paid their dues. They've gone through the trenches. There's not many guys that weren't in the same situation as everyone else back in the day working the juniors and minors. But that being said, I was able to still be able to get married and buy a house and start a family making what I did. Fortunately, my wife has a very good job, so that helped.
But it's always good to marry well.
Yes, I outkicked my coverage for sure.
Yeah, you got a beautiful life, beautiful family. For anybody that's thinking about getting into officiating, what are your warnings? What's your advice? What would you tell them about it? You know, whether you're doing it on a professional level as a goal or just doing it at a youth level, what's important for people to know?
I think the important thing is you got to go into it for the right reasons. If you're going into it just to get a paycheck, that's a disservice to the game. If you're going into it to make it to the NHL, it's almost impossible. It's almost like hitting the lottery to make it to the NHL. The attitude you need to have to go into it is that you have to be passionate about hockey. You have to love the sport, and you have to go out there with the mindset every game to do what you can to make that game better, to go enhance that game. You might go out there, it might be at 7 a.m. on a Saturday morning, and you're doing a mic game. And maybe you're hungover, maybe you don't want to be there. But you gotta remember, you got to keep – to somebody in that rink, that's the most important hockey game in their life. For those 40 kids playing and the parents in the stands, that's their game 7 of the Stanley Cup final every Saturday morning at 7 a.m. And if you go out there and you look like you don't want to be there and you don't give the work ethic that game needs, or you don't equal the work ethic the players are putting forth, then you're disrespecting the game and you're making us all officials, you're giving us a black eye. So go out there and just take it, work every game like it's the most important game and have fun with it. And if you only reach Bantam AA level, then try and be the best Bantam AA official that you can. Or if you're lucky to get into junior or minor pro, just try and be that best guy and try and make it your goal to get to the next level, the next level, the next level until you reach your peak. It opens up a lot of doors no matter what level you get to. Friendships and, I mean, I owe everything I have to the game. So I'm getting emotional, Mike.
It's a career retrospective. I know the feeling. Think about everything we've gotten to do and everything that we've experienced along the way with this. You know, look at us. 23, 24 years later, we shared the ice probably 1,000 times in our lives, you know? And it maybe not that many, but I mean, that's a lot of time on the ice with somebody. And it's a lot of time that in your youth developing and learning how to be a human being and, like, it really is. It's all because of the game.
Yeah.
You know, it's a sport.
Yeah, I mean, we were boys. We were kids. We were boys when we got into it. We were kids when we got into junior and even pro hockey, and we grew up with it. So it's, it's pretty neat.
It's amazing stuff, man. Well, I thank you for coming and telling your story, because I know we could do a round two easily, and we could probably just do Terry stories for a solid hour and a half.
Well, Mike, thank you for having me on, man.
Thanks for listening to 6 Degrees with Mike McKenna. Please make sure that you like, comment, leave a rating, subscribe, whether it's iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, anywhere that you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.